I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nothing's better than feeling comfortable in your own shoes. Maybe you're a parent raising a little rock star or a tech nomad working from anywhere. Allbirds wants you to be comfortable in your actual shoes, too. Their wool runners, pipers, and loungers are so cozy you might forget you're wearing them. And they're crafted from natural materials that tread lightly on our planet. So get comfortable in your shoes. Get to know the wool runners, pipers, and loungers at Allbirds.com. That's Allbirds.com.
It could be said that the history of life is a history of movement, a vast dance of inexorable entropic change. From the propulsion of the stars and the planets, to the vibrating of subatomic particles, and the stretching of space itself, it's useful to remember sometimes that even the most solid-seeming of objects are in one way or another in a constant kinetic state. Be that the glass in your window, the elements of a diamond, or even the earth under our feet. Let us then, for a moment, take one singular place and look upon it as an ageless being of omnipotence might observe it. You're listening to Unexplained, and I'm Richard MacLean Smith. At first, we see a minute speck hanging in the depths of space. Drawing closer, we see it is in fact a nameless planet moving around a nameless star. Drawing closer still, we see on the surface of that planet two gigantic landmasses set on an imperceptible but devastating collision course. And on the edge of one, we find our spot. The movement of the land is generated in part by the heat of the planet's core, a solid ball of iron nickel, raging at almost 5,500 degrees centigrade, that in turn heats a mantle layer below the planet's surface. This outer shell appears to be a static rock, composed mainly of silicon, iron, magnesium, oxygen, and aluminium. But of course, it is not still. Instead, it bends and creeps, cajoled by the planet's warm belly, expanding and contracting in convective circles as the heat rises and falls through the silicate layers. It is on this sea of rock and waves of heat that the two landmasses are being thrown toward each other. And on this planet, by our measurements, the days last just over 22 hours, and oxygen levels in the air are 50% higher than anything we have ever experienced. And there is life in plenty. Across the continents, owing to the humid climate, the land is smothered in vast swamps and enormous trees. Amphibious creatures dominate, while giant invertebrate arthropods wiggle and crawl in abundance. Some even fly, too, their twitching segmented bodies lifted into the air by gossamer wings over half a meter in span. The two continents draw ever closer until finally they collide to form one giant singular mass. As they merge, our spot is pushed and pulled as vast splinterings of rock rise into the sky to form mountains and rolling hills. Over time, the land beneath continues to move and break apart into many separate pieces. And over the land above, more and different creatures are taking their place. Entire species rising and falling while the planet spirals on through space as it continues to orbit the nameless star. A mere 300 million orbits later, and now the oxygen levels on the planet have depleted. The days have become longer. And from out of a central place, what was once four legs has become two. In herds, these strange bipedal creatures are dispersed throughout the planet. Eventually, they will learn to give themselves names, and names too for the many things around them, including the very planet they walk upon, which will become known as Planeta Zemlya, Jigu Hensong, or to others, Planet Earth. And those creatures will learn to tell stories, bringing ever greater potential for change. For now, not only does the material world change, but so too will the world that is mapped onto it in the minds of the creatures who walk upon it. Entire worlds that too can rise and fall in a matter of moments. As for our spot, it will eventually find itself nestled at the foothills of those same mountains formed 300 million years ago, still surviving today as one of the oldest mountain ranges on the planet. Those mountains will eventually find themselves encased in a country named Rossiya and will become known as Uralsky Gory, or as the Ural Mountains. So let us now get closer in time and space to the spot that we have marked. The Ural Mountains form a natural border between Europe and Asia, running 2,500 kilometers through western Russia, from the coast of the Kara Sea to the northwest border of Kazakhstan. And just to the east of the central Urals, we will find our region of interest. In 1723, Peter the Great, leader of the Russian Empire, establishes a town here that will be named Yekaterinburg after his wife, Yekaterina. Due to the abundance of minerals, vast resources of timber, and the deep waters of the Isit River, the location was a place of great natural beauty, but also a prime location for what would become the administrative mining capital of the Russian Empire. Just under 200 years later, and the city is firmly established as a focal point for the country's growing industrial appetite. And in that time, so much has changed. Not that we might notice, however. Certainly, the surrounding land, and even the city, to all intents and purposes, has remained fixed. But even as we look upon it now, invisible changes are taking place. As a primary industrial hub, Yekaterinburg has found itself a beating heart of a new world that has materialized around it. Having been a town built by royal decree to excavate natural resources that would then be turned into capital and wealth for a fortunate few, it is now a symbol and ode to those that generated the wealth, not through some strange alchemy, but through the blood and sweat of the many hands that scraped it from the earth. And so it is that at the beginning of the century, we find in our spot the same furnaces burning and the same coal brought from the land by the same hands, but the status of those hands has been elevated. 2,200 miles away, on April the 16th, 1917, a train will pull into Finland Station in St. Petersburg, carrying a man whose words on stepping onto the station platform will bring further winds of change. We watch as they provoke an internecine war, turning the people of the nation against each other in brutal and devastating ways. Back in Yekaterinburg, there is a mansion house belonging to a merchant named Ipatiev. But as we avert our gaze for a moment, a year has passed, and when we look again, we see the same bricks and mortar standing in the same place. Only now there is no Ipatiev, and the mansion has been renamed the House of Special Purpose of the Ural Soviet Committee. A year later, in the spring of 1918, seven highly prized prisoners, a family, will be escorted to Yekaterinburg and imprisoned in this House of Special Purpose. We see them now, in the early hours of July 17th, 1918, as they are raised from their beds and taken to a small room. They are told to sit and wait for a truck to come and take them away, but the truck never comes. Only a hail of bullets and thrusting bayonets that ends with the walls dripping in blood and the prisoners lying dead on the ground. We watch as the bodies are taken to an abandoned mine shaft and one by one are dropped to the bottom of it. It is the last time that Russia will ever know a royal family. Five years later, and the war is over. Yekaterinburg remains, but now finds itself not in Russia, but the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And though the name and rulers have changed, the minerals and ores in the ground are still very much in demand. To that end, a school has been established, named the Ural Polytechnic Institute, to promote better skills in the working classes to aid with increased production. The following year, we return to find the city as it was, only now it has a new name, Sverdlovsk. In the blink of an eye, just over 30 years have passed. It is 1959, and both Sverdlovsk and the Ural Polytechnic is much as we left it. We see the building's familiar majestic architecture, colonnaded at the front, underneath a vast pediment bearing the large embossed symbol of a hammer and a sickle. But in those 30 years, as ever, so much has changed, and a new ruler has replaced the old, ushering an end to an era of almost unparalleled upheaval. In that time, an old enemy has risen and fallen from the west, and some, considered enemies from within, have fallen too. And now the deaths of over 40 million people haunt the land. The mindset of an entire country has been altered, and a new war stalks the people of this vast nation. Holodnoye Voyna, or the Cold War, as it will come to be known. The new leader, Nikita Khrushchev, has promised a thawing of the old ways, and a new generation are ready to embrace it. A generation embodied by the bright and enthusiastic students of the Ural Polytechnic Institute. And so it is that on Friday, January the 23rd, 1959, finally, we arrive at the beginning of one more story to scatter across the foothills of the Ural Mountains. A story that is perhaps the most extraordinary of all the stories featured on the show so far. A chilling and profound mystery that remains to this day unexplained. We begin at the Ural Polytechnic Institute, in room 531. Seven students are crammed inside the Spartan dormitory, frantically shoving various bits and pieces into backpacks. Cans of meat, followed by packets of oatmeal, survival knives, and even a cooking stove. Nothing is forgotten. But rather than chaos, it is the steady haste of a well-oiled team. They are preparing for a difficult mountain hike deep into the Urals, towards Otorten Mountain. The journey will involve at least 16 days of trekking through the Siberian tundra on a path that many consider one of the toughest at this time of year. And it will need to be, since all are hoping to achieve their Category 3 hiking certificate upon completion. It is the highest awarded category in the country, and one that will require the team to cover over 300 kilometers of ground, spending at least 8 days in completely uninhabited regions. One boy, Yuri Krivonishenko, looks perturbed for a moment as he hunts around the room, his face brightening into a huge grin when he finally finds his leather boots. Yuri, also known as Georgi, is the joker of the group, and at 23, also one of the oldest. A recent graduate of construction and hydraulics, back in September of 1957, Georgi had been assigned to work at a secret nuclear facility called Chelyabinsk 40, when the plutonium plant experienced a catastrophic radioactive leak. Georgi was part of the team who was sent in to clean up the mess. He packs his leather boots away, then makes some space for his much-loved mandolin. "Do you think I can play it on the train?" he asks. "Of course," shout the others, in warm reply. In the corner of the dorm, keeping a watchful eye over the preparations, is the diligent and methodical Alexander Kolovatov. At 24, Alexander is the oldest member of the group. A kind soul with a penchant for smoking antique pipes, Alexander was a distinguished student in the field of nuclear physics, who had also studied in Moscow at a secret institute known as the Ministry of Medium Machine Building, before returning to Sverdlovsk to complete his physics major. "Who has the salt?" shouted Zinaida Kolmogorova, or Zina, as she is known to her friends. Although only 20, Zina is in her fourth year of radio engineering and is a tough and experienced hiker. Known affectionately as the engine of the university, Zina's magnetic charm rarely went unnoticed, not least by a number of the boys in the team. "Where are Doroshenko and Igor?" she asks suddenly. "Let me have 15 cents to call them." The question is directed at Ludmila Dubanina, the only other woman in the group. Luda is only 20 and the youngest in the team. A focused and committed communist, the athletic Luda is practically a poster girl for the party, and like Zina, is possessed of an inner steel, equal, if not superior, to any of her male compatriots. On one expedition to the Sayan Mountains, she was accidentally shot by a tourist, but didn't complain once during her long and painful journey back home, except to apologize for troubling the group. Luda hands Zina the 15 cents from the pile of cash she is diligently counting up. Meanwhile, Rustik is teasing Kolya over who has more willpower to survive the trip without their beloved cigarettes. Rustik is Rustem Slobodin, another recent graduate of the institute. Unlike the others, Rustik comes from a wealthy family of academics, but he carries none of the sense of entitlement that such wealth can sometimes entail. As perhaps the most popular member of the team, it would seem that Rustik had lived up to the Tartar name that his father had bestowed on him as a symbol of international friendship to all men and women. In marked contrast, Nikolai Thibault-Brignol's background could not have been more different. Born in a concentration camp, Kolya had been brought up by his mother on her own after his French communist father had been executed as part of Stalin's ruthless purges. Kolya had graduated from the institute in 58, after majoring in civil engineering, and with a reputation for unselfish behavior, was a man always looking to help others. Today holds mixed emotions for Kolya. He had promised to his mother that this trip would be his last, and he would miss moments like these the most. The giddy, nervous energy of the team just before the journey begins. Someone throws a couple of bags to Yuri Yudin, who deposits them outside, ready to load onto the truck that will take them to the station. The 21-year-old Yuri, a geology student at the institute, had endured a tough and impoverished upbringing, and also suffered greatly from rheumatism in his leg joints. But Yuri had always determined never to let his affliction dictate his life. There is a great cheer when Yuri Doroshenko finally arrives to join the group. The much-loved 21-year-old radio engineer had a fearsome reputation, having once successfully fended off a black bear with nothing but a geologist's hammer. His entrance is followed shortly after by Igor Dyatlov. A student of radio engineering, 23-year-old Igor was a formidable athlete and easily the most experienced hiker in the team. Strong, thoughtful, and confident, he was a natural fit as their leader. He was also prodigiously talented, having designed and assembled a radio at the age of 20 that would later be used on class hikes. With the final checks complete, the group gather their things and move out. 20 minutes later, after a short tram ride to the city station, the team are settled into a Class 3 cabin as the train pulls away from Sverdlovsk. Such moments are usually cause for reflection, to be leaving behind your hometown on a treacherous journey into the wilderness. But in this moment, they are distracted by a stranger in their midst. Are you always taking care of your family? Do you often take care of others and not yourself? Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. You deserve it. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best, to feeling like yourself again. With Teladoc, you can speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video. Therapy appointments are available 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time. If you feel overwhelmed sometimes, maybe you feel stressed or anxious, depressed or lonely, or you might be struggling with a personal or family issue, Teladoc can help. Teladoc is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy to change counsellors if needed, for free. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast. Igor introduces his handsome, dark-haired friend to the group as Sasha. At 37, he is considerably older than the others, and although not by any means old, he appears as if from another age. So the young students might be forgiven their palpable sense of trepidation when Sasha reveals a mouth full of gold teeth from underneath his wolfish smile. Their sense of unease is not helped by the sight of a number of tattoos dotted about his body. But their unease is not out of rudeness, more from the tacit awareness that they are in the presence of a ghost. At 37 years old, Sasha is part of a generation of which only 3% remain, having been decimated by the brutality of the Great Patriotic War. Though it is unlikely he would have forgotten much from the 5 years he served from 1941 to 1946, Sasha bears a constant reminder of those he had lost. Three initials inked onto his skin, followed by an equal sign, and the symbol for friendship. Semyon Zolotatov, to give him his full name, has been working as a tour guide in South Siberia, and like the others, is desperate to achieve his Grade 3 certificate. Before long, the team recognize a kindred spirit, and any initial sense of unease is quickly banished by the sound of Georgi's mandolin as he strikes up to play. Together, as the train speeds on through the Ural countryside, they sing all the songs that they know, while behind them, Sverdlovsk recedes further and further until it has entirely disappeared from view. 10 hours later, and the train finally pulls into Serov, a small town 350 kilometers due north of Sverdlovsk. With their next train not due to leave until 6:30 p.m., the exhausted team are hoping to escape the cold and maybe get some sleep in the station waiting room, but are disappointed to find it locked for the day. Georgi attempts to cheer up his friends with a comical busking routine, but his singing has attracted the attention of two guards. A sign, perhaps, that they have already entered a different world to the one encased within their dormitory walls. The guards grab Georgi from the platform and push him into their office. A short time later, and a somewhat stunned Georgi is returned to the platform after being let off with a stern warning for contravening Article 2.3 of the Internal Order at railway stations. Not wanting to hang around, the team head off in search of shelter when they come across an empty school hall. After knocking on the door, they are met by the kind face of the school's janitor. Much to their relief, she takes pity on the young hikers and invites them inside to rest and warm themselves. But there is one condition. In return, they must give a talk to the school children before they leave. A few hours later, and Zina and Sasha have the children hanging on their every word as they listen wide-eyed and attentively to their tales of adventure. When it is finally time to go, the children have to be peeled, sobbing and crying, from Zina before finally accepting her promise to one day return. The children wave and shout goodbye to their 10 new favourite heroes as they watch them head back to the train station. Finally, the team are on the move again, and by midnight they have arrived in the small town of Evedel. Since leaving Sverdlovsk, the gang had been shadowed by another team of hikers from the Institute, led by their good friend Yuri Blinov. That night of January the 24th, they all sleep huddled together in the Evedel station waiting room until the following morning, when they catch the first tram to Evedel town centre. The town is built on the confluence of the Evedel River and the Lozva River, and like most towns in the region, Evedel had been established as a mining colony, in this case for gold. But in 1937, the town had taken on a second purpose, becoming the location of Evedeleg Gulag. The term is an acronym that translates to Main Administration of Corrective Labour Camps. The camps had been set up during Stalin's time, partly as corrective facilities for criminals, but were often also used to dispense with political prisoners. A fact that would no doubt have crossed Kolya's mind, at least, as the hikers made their way into the town centre, with some consideration perhaps for the desperate souls hidden away somewhere beyond the snow-topped roofs of the town's outskirts. They don't have to wait long before their bus arrives, and soon after, the team are moving through the white-blanketed countryside as the bus forges ahead towards Vize, the next stop on their journey. But there is something wrong. Alexander is missing. They must have left him behind at the last toilet break. The team yell to the bus driver to pull over. A quick headcount confirms their fears. Alexander is indeed missing, but there is nothing that can be done. With the bus on a tight schedule, the driver has no choice but to continue the journey. "But wait," says Yuri. As far off, a small shape, steadily growing larger, reveals itself to be a fully laden Alexander, sprinting with all his strength toward them. "I thought you'd left," he sputters between gasps for breath. "Never," say the others, as they haul his exhausted body back onto the bus. Just after 2 p.m, they arrive at Vize and the hikers disembark. The town is a woodcutting settlement that served as a central hub from which further outposts could be reached. From here, the two teams will go their separate ways. For Blinov and his team, a bus heading their way to Sector 105 is due to leave later in the afternoon. For Iga's group, however, they will have to stop here for the night. That afternoon, the team's many cameras, vital for recording evidence for their Category 3 certificates, are whipped out as they say their final goodbyes to Blinov and his team. Despite the minus 17 degree temperature, the classmates smile and fool around as they pose for one final picture. Moments later, Yuri and his team scramble into the back of a flatbed truck and wave a fond goodbye to their friends as they pull away and out of the camp. For Igor's team, it will be one last night of domesticity before heading off into the wilderness. The team are especially excited to hear of a nearby screening room and will pile in later that evening to watch a film called Symphony in Gold. Rustic finds time to write a postcard to his mother, and Doroshenko and Alexander make a number of final checks and adjustments to the equipment. That night, with two crammed to a bed, and Georgi and Sasha taking positions on the floor, the team sleep soundly. The next morning, they are up and dressed early, eager to get on the road again. But something is bugging Yuri. A pain in his legs that had been steadily growing was threatening to become unbearable. Despite his misgivings, he was determined not to let the others down and decided to ignore it for now. But there is also something else. The previous afternoon, an experienced forester had expressed concern about the group's trip, thinking it too dangerous for them at this time of year. Igor had laughed it off in typically bullish style. After all, wasn't that precisely the reason that they were taking the trip in the first place? Yuri had laughed too, but as he prepared to board the truck for their ride out of Vizay, it was with the old man's words still ringing in his ears. The journey didn't help much either. Sitting at the back of the rickety open-air truck, the team struggled for warmth and comfort. But as any traveller knows, it is from such experiences that true bonds are made. And before long, the gang were once again singing songs and speaking of love and friendship as they travelled ever higher into the frostbitten Ural Mountains. Sector 41 was a workers' outpost occupied by roughly 50 woodsmen stationed on long-term contracts, many of whom had gone months cut off from the world. So it was with no little excitement that the new faces of the young students were welcomed into the workers' homes that evening. As for Dyatlov and his team, they were treated to a glimpse of another world, revealed through the songs and poems shared by the workers that night, many of them illegal and punishable under Article 58 of Counter-Revolutionary Crimes. But even for the committed communist Luda, it was a night to remember. The next morning, on January the 27th, the team awake to find a beautiful, clear blue sky waiting for them. After 850 kilometers, finally the time has come to put on their skis and begin the trek to Otorten Mountain. A local man named Slava offers to lend them his sled and horse to help carry their heavy equipment to their next stop, a settlement known as North 2. The settlement is an old geological research site, just 24 kilometres to the north, now abandoned and home to little more than 2,000 dilapidated cabins. It is late in the afternoon when Slava returns with his sled, but after securing the luggage and fastening their skis, the team are finally en route towards North 2. The journey takes them over the frozen waters of the Ushma River, deeper and deeper into the forest, but the thin ice is proving tricky for the horse to negotiate. After 2 hours, the team have only made it a third of the way, but as the winter sun drops down behind a distant ridge, the team continue on unperturbed. Another 4 hours later, and Igor spots something ahead. Under the soft light of the moon, they can just make out the shape of a hut against the tree line. As their eyes adjust, suddenly, a sprawling pastoral ghost town has appeared before them. They have reached the North 2 settlement. The woodsman had recommended one hut in particular that was still habitable, and somehow, after a short time stumbling around in the dark, they managed to find it. That night, approaching the log cabin on the edge of the forest, under the moonlight, it is as if they have crossed some kind of threshold and stepped right into a fairy tale. Old Slavic folk stories tell of a grotesque witch with fearsome iron teeth by the name of Baba Yaga, who lives in a hut deep in the heart of the forest. She is a complex creature that is sometimes good, but at other times utterly monstrous. Given to eating her victims, without a moment's hesitation. It is said that she travels in a large pestle and mortar that flies through the trees with a sickening, grinding screech, and that her hut stands atop of a pair of chicken's feet. But there are no such feet under the cabin that night, and the air remains silent with the eerie quietude that only an abandoned village can conjure up. Before long, there is life once again in Sector North 2, as the darkness of the cabin is illuminated by the sound of young voices, filled with the relief of finding shelter for the night, and then shortly after, by the flickering glow of lamplight. A few of the boys volunteer to find firewood from outside by pulling up wood from some of the more dilapidated cabins. At one point, Rustic grabs at one, only to pull away in pain. He looks closely at his hand and sees a small pinprick from an old nail hidden in the dark. He watches for a moment as the prick becomes a drop of blood on the surface of his skin. A short time later, and the fire is roaring and filling the room with the comforting, sweet-smelling smoke of the hearth. The following morning, and Yuri Yudin's legs have finally given in. After struggling even to stand, it is clear that he is at the point of no return. With Slava due to head back to Sector 41 that day, he has little option but to join him. With sincere disappointment, he breaks the news to the rest of the group, who are all equally devastated to be saying goodbye so early to their friend. As a keen geologist, Yuri is determined not to return empty-handed, and manages to corral a small team to join him on the hunt for some interesting samples to take back home. But despite the area's abundance of precious stones and minerals, Yuri is saddened only to find quartz and fool's gold hidden under the snow. With Slava eager to get going, Yuri loads his pack onto the back of the sled and gingerly steps into his skis. The team say their final goodbyes and take one last picture of their friend before he leaves. And so it is that on the morning of Wednesday, January the 28th, that the 10-strong team, led by Igor Dyatlov, becomes 9. Before he is out of sight, Yuri turns one last time to wave a final goodbye to the team. He couldn't possibly have known then that it will be the last time his friends will ever be seen alive again. All Elements of Unexplained are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show on iTunes, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or on Twitter at unexplainedpod. Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best. Speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video anytime between 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time, 7 days a week. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.